Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00053. Recorded on July 5, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Mr. Appropriation. Mr. Appropriation. Chapter 53.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Post-Harlan Monologics is a monologue format audio podcast. It is what has become known in the common era as infotainment, which is to say the content is both informative and entertaining. Hopefully. The premise of Post-Harlan Monologics is a description of conditions in the 21st century AD from a DFW perspective by an aging building maintenance guy. That is me, Maverick 88. I cover odd shit from my weird neighborhood, product reviews, Texas things, holy scripture, and the culture war. Fair warning, I am Texan by choice. But I was raised in New Jersey, so take cover, there will be F-bombs. For more information, please visit www.post-harlan.com. Okay, time to get it in.
In the neighborhood. News from the home front.
I don't like the idea that comes to mind. I record, right? The podcast is a process, and it's a one-man show, and I don't expect it to ever be anything otherwise. But it's more than just talking into a microphone, you know? There's planning. There's upfront planning that goes with it. There's post-production stuff that goes with it. They're setting up the entire environment, right? There's a website that has to be established and paid for and maintained and updated, you know, all the time. And well, there's just a lot more to this than meets the eye or meets the ear, as the case may be. Audio podcast, as this one is. And as I go through these steps in the process, you know, part of it is after I record the voice parts and I go into post-production and I kind of got to put everything together, right? The editing and arranging and all this kind of stuff. I always have to listen back, right? I have to always listen back to whatever it's done. And I don't like that part in general, right? I don't do this to hear myself. It may be amusing in that regard a couple years down the road. It also may be horrendous a couple years down the road. Who's to say, you know? As I grow and change, I don't know that I want to look back and hear myself like half retarded as I was a couple years ago, right? You know the point I'm trying to make. On the other hand, it might be good and solid stuff, and good for triggering memories and nostalgia and things like that, right? But I go through this process not to listen to myself. I don't like to listen to myself. It's kind of uncomfortable and disconcerting, but I got to do it because it doesn't get done otherwise. And there's certain things that hit me on a weekly basis, right? I've got this format that I've just changed to. I've graduated to after the first 50 episodes. Now I'm trying this other thing where I'm kind of sectioning things, categorizing, grouping topics for the idea that I can kind of split them out into smaller segments and get them out on social media that way, if I ever find the fucking time to actually sit down there and do the production involved with it, right? But at least I've got the format, the capability. I've got audio files divided in play, all that good stuff, right? But part of listening back is the recurring themes that happen within the categories I've drawn up. Let me just cut to the chase here. Let me tell you what I mean. When I do this in the neighborhood section, right, I'm talking about odd shit in my neighborhood. Now, odd shit could be people, it can be places, it can be things, whatever. Shit is that generic term, you know, like stuff, and it's just whatever, but within the confines of my neighborhood. It gets to being people every so often, probably more often than not. And so I'm describing to you people in the neighborhood, the ones that really stand out as pretty fucking weird, right? And I listen back to that. I'm like, well, my intent is not to say, oh, look how weird that guy is. Thank God I'm not as weird as him, right? I don't mean to put myself above anybody. What I mean to do is draw a picture for you, the listener, to get an idea of what circumstances are like in my little corner of DFW not only the post-Arlen era as it is, but also the post-COVID era as it's become, right? So I'm giving you very real, trivial detail by describing the environment around me. But sometimes I feel I have to be mindful and put myself in that environment also. Not to exclude me. Not to be a fly in the wall, because I am literally plunked down right in the middle of the fucking neighborhood. I am in the middle of my block, and my block is in the middle of the whole section, right? I'm right in the middle of it all. I'm not an outsider looking in. I am right down and plunked in the middle. And I've got my peculiarities as well. There is no doubt that if a person on my block wanted to do a podcast, perhaps didn't know me personally, they could point the finger at me and describe this guy as, how do you even begin? It's the fucking new millennium, and you got this jackass walking around in cowboy clothes and a cowboy hat. Nobody does that. What a fucking weirdo. But he's always carrying a gun. He's always got a gun on his belt. And he's always got some kind of knife. And if you listen, you hear him yelling through the paper-thin walls of his house. Oh, yelling shit, right? If you can't hear the words, you would think that I was yelling at my wife, you know, which is never the case at all. We've never had a fight. We've never had an argument. We've never had a disagreement. But I will yell at the dogs, especially my pit bull who's gone deaf. He doesn't hear me unless I yell, right? So you might hear the yelling. And then you put all that together and you got this image of some guy who's like highly armed and volatile and dangerous, right? That's one way of looking at it. And I guess if the person was speaking, you know, who was ever making observations about me was on the liberal, the leftist end of everything, of course, they would bring into the idea of all this well, heterosexual stuff and racist stuff, you know, because I'm white, I'm a white supremacist, you know. I could be depicted as that, you know, just to fall into the categories. But in their eyes, right, I would be fucking weird. In their world, if you're a, well, I got lesbians across the street, right? Two lesbians live right across the street. In their eyes, I'm a fucking weirdo. In their world, everything is rainbows and unicorns, right? And they look at me as something foreign. And everything I do would be peculiar to them. And they would describe me much in a way like I would describe our friend from last week, the wheelbarrow man, for example, right? I think that guy is really weird, and I think anybody listening to me would think that guy is really weird too. But what I got to remember, and this is my point here, is that somebody's going to think I'm really weird, right? There's plenty of people in the world that would look at me and think that way automatically. Automatically. Now, I didn't always wear a cowboy hat. I wasn't always from Texas, right? To me, I come to Texas as a transplant, right? And I had to earn the right to actually wear a cowboy hat to express myself as traditional Texan. It was part of the process of assimilation in my eyes. And, you know, the fact that I would even think that I would have to assimilate to some Texas culture is part of my own peculiarity, right? There's a lot of people that have moved to Texas, but how many of us have that desire to go through some kind of self-induced process of assimilation to qualify himself as a viable citizen of Texas, right? Probably close to fucking none, you know, outside of me, right? There might be another oddball or two like that out there. But not likely, and you don't see them walking around. You know, the cowboy hats and all that stuff. Yeah, cowboy hats and Dallas area, few and far between. Get out in the country, obviously you see it more, right? But this is a melting pot zone. And even when I did, you know, even when I got myself to feeling qualified to wear a cowboy hat, I didn't know the first thing about cowboy hats, and I bought all stupid flea market garbage, right? But B, I remember going to the doctor one day, right? I was going to the doctor in the town where I work, and I used to live back in the day. And I walked in, and I had a cowboy hat on. And he looked at me, and he laughed at me. What, you been to the rodeo? That's what he said. But the idea that nobody wears cowboy hats except, like, rodeo people. And I just didn't see it in that regard. I saw it, and I still see it as emblematic of Texas, right? In his eyes, in the doctor's eyes, it was a joke. And there's my example. Somebody like that doctor, for example, would look at a person like me and think I'm oddball, that I'm strange, that I'm peculiar. And I'm not going to disagree. We all have our perspective on shit, right? So it's true. We're all weirdos. I guess that's the ultimate point of it. But the specific point I'm trying to make is I am one too. I'm a weirdo in my own way, and I recognize it. Right? Maybe I don't know precisely how I strike everybody as weird, but I do know that I strike somebody as weird somehow. That's my point. Yeah, I'm a fucking weirdo in my own way. I don't mean to belittle other people, demean other people, or step on the backs or shoulders of other people while they're down to elevate me. I'm pretty low on the totem pole in this world, right? I got to admit I'm a step or two over the gutter, because I've been in the gutter, and I know, right? I know I speak frequently about recovering from drug addiction and alcoholism. I am coming up, shit, a couple of days. By the time I get this out to the ears of the world, you know, it'll be 35 years clean and sober. So I was down in the gutter. I was at that low bottom point in the gutter, and I'm not there no more. So I'm somewhere different. in so many different ways, right? But that does not mean that I am any kind of member of high society or proper society at all. Nor do I want to be, right? Nor do I want to be. The price for that shit is your soul. That's obvious. That's obvious. When you look around you. So it's not my aspiration. I don't want to be Illuminati. I don't want to be elite. You know, I don't want to be blue blood. I don't want to be fucking skull and crossbones. I don't want to be a celebrity. Excuse me. I don't want to be a celebrity. I don't want to be none of that shit. I'm just a dude. I'm good with that, right? And I'm good with that. So, I do not get to speak of life in the village from my precipice high above. I'm down in it. I'm down in it. And I'm just telling the tale. And now you understand that I am part of that tale, right? So, yeah, understand that I, too, am weird. And now what this weirdo has done in the neighborhood, right? Getting away from people watching and talking and shit, you know, behind their back, basically. I have one of my dozen hobbies is ammo reloading, right? And it's quite an involved hobby. And I have set up in an outbuilding we have in the backyard, a station to do this. You know, I have presses set up and tools and all the components and all this stuff, right? A few years back, I put all this stuff together, you know, and I made this very organized situation, but I can never get to it. We got two motorcycles in there. It's always a pain in the ass. In the summer, it's hot as fucking hell out there. In the winter, it could be really cold. And I've just gotten out of the habit. I haven't made one bullet in months and months, almost a year maybe. I don't know. I don't remember the last time, but it's been a while. In fact, the last encounter I've had with reloading was I actually commissioned a friend of mine to make bullets for me. Even though I got all the shit and I can do it myself, I can't seem to find the time or the desire to go sit out there. So I made a decision, you know. I'm looking at my situation in general. I am very burdened with the responsibilities of my domestic situation, you know, the house as it is inside and out. And also I've got all these hobbies to attend to that I'm not attending to. And I thought, well, you know what? If I brought a lot of the situation into my new office and studio, which has become like the core of my universe, right? It's where I'm doing my work, doing my thing, whatever thing is getting done, like this podcast, for example, it's getting done there. Whatever is getting done, like a book I'm working on, a theological paper, right? It's getting done there. When I have to sharpen a knife, it's getting done there. When I play guitar, it's getting done there. When I compose music, it's getting done there. Well, how about some of the other shit that I do? How about we get that in that room and it can get done there too, right? And then a lot of things kind of fall into place with that. So I got this idea to order up a new workbench, stick it in my studio, right? Because the workbench I got out in the outbuilding, the workshop, is too long for the area, right? Big old long thing. It's great. I love it. I've had a couple of them in my life. A Home Depot, little wooden jobs. Used to buy them for $75. I've had several of them, you know. They became hard to find, but I did get that one a few years back. But it's too big for inside, so I had to get something smaller. I got a 4-foot thing, Harbor Freight. I sent my wife off on a mission. She came back with it, and over the weekend, I put that thing together. Now I've been in the process, starting yesterday, of starting to migrate all of my reloading stuff to this new workspace inside, right? So that's what I'm doing. It ain't done yet. I'm maybe halfway through. I still got to move the presses, you know, disconnect them and set them up again all new. And I've actually ordered a bookcase for storage that'll fit right in the spot right there. And there are some things to do, but I'm busy with that. So I may be getting back into reloading when I have that right there in front of me, easily accessible. So I may be talking about that kind of shit a little bit more, hopefully, as the days go by, right? As the weeks go by. So, yeah, getting back into that. At least that's a start. It's a start. I got to pull everything I got together. There's a lot of bullets that I made that did not pass the quality control at the gun range. I've got to sort them. I got to find them, locate them, identify them, make sure they don't ever end up in the mix. I got to take them apart. I got to start over, you know. Fucked up components got to get thrown away or recycled, repurposed. But I got a lot to do. Yeah, I got a lot to do with all that stuff. I'm a little bit excited about it, you know, making that change and just kind of drawing everything. Now, they're drawing everything into one central area, at least to the best of my ability. I got other hobbies that will never be inside, like the motorcycle. That's never coming inside, right? But when I get the all the reloading stuff inside, I'm also going to have a place for leather stuff. I'm not a big leather maker guy, but I can make good knife sheaths, and I'll eventually try to make holsters, God will, and the creek don't rise and there's time on the clock, right? But the leather work comes inside, right? So that's two hobbies that come in. When I start exercising the reloading hobby, that's going to force my ass to the gun range, which goes to the shooting hobby, you know? So I would get the brake guns out and go shooting, which I haven't been doing much of for many months now. I was supposed to do that over the long weekend with my wife. She wants to go out, and I just didn't. I forgot about it until it was too late. But anyhow, I'll bring the leather craft stuff in. I can start working on that. And again, sheaths I've made. I've made some excellent basic knife sheaths, you know, custom to knives that I have. And I have knives that need some custom shit made at this time. But then also, I could do like minor boot, you know, boot repair, leather boot repair, cowboy boot repair, and not just repair, but I can completely redo boots. I have one pair of cowboy boots I bought brand new. They're expensive. I got them at a discount because they were kind of undesirable. They were weird colors, right? It was a weird color scheme. And I looked at it, and for the price, I got quality. Made in Texas boots of all materials, made in America, Anderson Bean, right? Great boots. And these were just a hideous color scheme, which I was able to completely change and correct. Now I got a very desirable pair of boots, right? So I'm able to do that. If I ever wanted to touch up or change up my any of my boots, that's part of the whole leather works thing that I do also. But that's beside the point for now. It's not what I'm trying to get to with this. Is now I get all that stuff out of the workshop. Now I've got a large workbench out there and shelving cabinet space over it to put tools that I can't get to because the fucking motorcycles are always in the way. You hear what I'm saying? So I could get my power tools in a more accessible place, which means that I will be more quickly able to get at outside projects, inside, whatever, projects that require power tools, inside or out, don't matter, and not be encumbered by the whole having to move the motorcycles out of the way. And it's more of a pain in the ass than it sounds, because I have to pull that shit out. Then where I'm doing the cutting, I have to do away from the bikes, because you don't want sawdust and shit to get all over the bikes. You go off to do work in some other part of the yard, you have the bikes out, you got to be concerned about fucking storms and rains coming. You got to have an eye open for weirdos in the neighborhood who are going to come and fuck with the bikes, trying to steal them, because they will. And It's just a pain in the ass. And just the weight of that aggravation will cause me to put a lot of projects off, right? To some other unknown day out in the future behind door number two. So this kind of opens the floodgates, at least a little bit. The accessibility to a lot of my power tools, which are buried on a shelf behind two motorcycles currently, right? And it's a small outbuilding, and you know, my wife's uncle has a bunch of shit in one area of it that still hasn't been removed. But even that area would be behind motorcycles, right? This is something right up front. I can open the door, I walk in, and right there to the right, I got a bench that has power tools on it, and I could just grab them and go. Don't have to worry about the bikes, you know? To me, it's a big deal. Maybe it sounds like nothing. Maybe it's petty to y'all, but it's a big deal to me. Because I'm always at that shit, and I'm always aggravated by this shit. So, they're killing a lot of birds with this stone, you know, moving the leather work and moving the ammo reloading indoors. Maybe a game changer for me. We'll see how that goes, but that's in the neighborhood, you know? Me the weirdo and all my weird shit.
Objectification. Maverick 88. Product and service reviews.
I got a new knife. Yes, I did. You got to expect it's coming, you know. Every month or so, there's going to be a new knife come in. And every other week or so, I'm probably going to be talking about old knives because I'm into knives. I'm just a weirdo. And that's part of my peculiarity, right? Knives and stuff. But I got this. This one's a beauty, too. This one's a beauty. I got the... it's called the Tops, T-O-P-S, right? That's the name of the knife manufacturer, Tops. The Tops Steel Eagle 105D, right? 105D is one in a series of a variety of Steel Eagle knives by Tops Knives. The 105D is a 5-inch variant, and my particular one has the Tento blade on it. Now, this is new. I'm the first kid on the block with this knife. The knife itself, the Steel Eagle by Tops, is old. It goes way back, right? But typically, it was a 7-inch version, right? And at some point, they tried to do a smaller 5-inch version, but they kind of thinned the steel down and changed the blade shape. And it wasn't very popular, right? It doesn't look good. So what they did was they went to the original 7-inch design, made it 5 inches, kept everything the same, just made it shorter, and then they made a variety that had this Tento on it. It's just fucking cool. It's just one of the knives, one of those things in life you just can't get your eyes past, right? I've had a few, right? I have this white Gretsch guitar, which I should speak about one of these weeks, you know. I call it God's guitar. I got a tattoo of it on my arm, right? I love the thing, and I always have. I had gone into a guitar center up in Plano, Texas, as it was some years ago, like 5-6 years ago. And I was going in with the idea that I was going to come out with an American acoustic guitar. I was going to trade in a couple of guitars. I was going to spend money I didn't really even have, put it all together, and try to walk out of there with a Marshall or a Taylor, perhaps a Gibson, whichever one I liked, you know. My price point was going to be like around $1,300 because that's bottom shelf for American-made acoustic guitars. I'm walking in there, and they have the acoustic guitar room in the back, right, the back of the building. So you got to walk through everything to get to it. And I'm on my way walking through to get to it, and at a corner of my eye, There's a wall of guitars, right? You've been in a guitar center. They got a wall of guitars, like, what, three or four stacked high, and just wall to fucking wall. Massive amounts of guitars. And that's all the electric stuff up there. So every shape, every color, you know? And I walk by, and at a corner of my eye, in the whole morass of the variety, electric guitars hanging on the wall, there's just one plain white one glowing like the fucking sun on angel's wings, right? It froze me in my tracks. I stopped and I looked at it, and I'm like, look at that fucking thing, right? And I just kept on going with my plan. I turned and I walked to the acoustic room, and I'm pulling the $1,300 American-made guitars off the wall, and I'm playing them and trying to decide, all right, how am I going to do this? Which one do I want? I was really thinking it was the Martin that I was going to come out with. That had been a little ambition of mine in my life. Martins are great guitars. But side by side, direct comparison with its Taylor equal, I found the Taylor to be a better guitar for me, you know, for my taste. And I'm not reviewing this, you know, it's not a product review for Martins or Taylors or guitars in general. What I'm trying to do is tell a story, right? I actually, and this is just for the hell of saying it, I preferred, you know, the Taylor to the Martin. Guitars at the same price point, both made in America. The Taylor was a better guitar to me, to my taste. The Martin seemed a little muddy. The Taylor had a little spring in his step. At that point in time, they either didn't have, or at least that store didn't have, a comparable Gibson. Well, as fate would have it, eventually I got the Gibson, right? There would become a Gibson at that price point, and I got it, and I love it. I play it all the time. That's my first grab guitar. If I just got 5-10 minutes to burn, I grab that quick. Don't plug in or anything like that, no effects. Just play. Play the fucking guitar, right? It's electric acoustic. Great guitar. I'll talk about that more. So I made the decision, all right, I guess I'm going to go with this here Taylor, right? And I'm walking out, seeing if I could get, you know, some kind of help or anything. And again, there's that white guitar glowing like the sun on angel's wings, you know, right out of heaven between the clouds on that fucking wall. And I was like, you know what? Let me go look at that thing. This was not in the plans at all. And I went and I looked at that thing. It turned out to be a Gretsch. What the hell is it? A 52? I really ought to know. My God, I can't believe I don't. But it's a $900 Gretsch guitar. It's a top of the line Electromatic series guitar. If you know anything about Gretsch, their guitars are hollow bodies. Electromatic is kind of like a middle of the road line that they have, and then within that line they've got some that are greater than others. This is really the top of the line, right? And then, you know, from that $900+ price point, there's a real gap to the next level of Gretsch hollow bodies, which is probably like $2,500, right? And there's nothing really in between at all, you know? You want something good, you're going to spend. You want something that's all right, you know, the middle of the road, the high middle of the road guitar. You're going to be in it around $1,000, taxes and everything. And that's what that guitar was. It's just a play. It's wonderful. Really a great guitar. Bigsby and everything. It's fucking great, right? It's your traditional rockabilly guitar. It's just white. It's not a white Falcon. It's just white. But it's bright white. It glows. And I loved it. The feel. Instantly, it was kismet, you know? And I said, forget about the fucking Taylor. Forget about the Martin. Forget about the acoustics. I'm getting this guitar. And I traded like three other guitars towards it. And paid the rest in cash. I had a hollow body guitar. I like the hollow bodies. I do. That's my go-to. But anyway, okay, I say all of that, right? All this guitar stuff while I'm talking about nice stuff, because that was an example of something I could not just get my eye past. It wasn't part of the plan. I saw it. And then I tried to ignore it, and I saw it, and I tried to ignore it, and then fuck it, I can't ignore this thing anymore, right? This knife, this Topps Steel Eagle 105D was one of those. They started putting pictures up on it, and a couple of weeks ago, they did one of the big knife shows last year, 2022. They were introducing it as a potential for this year coming up. You know, they weren't released yet. They had like a prototype. They were showing it. And I was like, look at that fucking knife. And for the needs, right? If you listen to me, you know I'm always looking for that perfect work knife. This might solve it. It's big and chunky, right? It's a heavy ass knife. It's 1/4 inch thick steel, right? Let me get into the specs of this thing. Your eyes need to see it, right? I'm talking about not being able to visually get past this thing and just ignore it. But again, this is an audio podcast. We do the best we can do. It is the, like I said, the Topps Knives Steel Eagle 105D Tanto blade, right? It's a fixed blade. Overall length, 10.5 inches. The blade length, 5, a little bit more than 5. 5 1/8 maybe. It's a 5-inch blade, more or less. Not huge, right? Not huge. Cutting edge, 5 inches. So most of that is cutting edge. Again, it's a Tanto style. The blade thickness, which is impressive, right? 1/4 inch. 1/4 inch is usually reserved for a real large chopper knife. I have my foot right here as I speak in the recording in the F-150 mobile studio. I have an Ontario Knives SP-53 Bolo knife, and that is a fucking wood chopper, tree chopper. Its spine is 1/4 inch thick too, but it's also like 9 or 10 inch blade. It's fucking huge and heavy and badass, right? That's the kind of knife you cut somebody's like arm off in one shot, you know. So this knife, this 5-inch knife, this little guy in comparison is equally thick. It ain't breaking, right? It ain't breaking. Very thick blade, and I like that, right? I call it a chunkster. It's small. Comparably small. This is a big knife compared to like a pocket knife and shit like that. It's this huge, right? But it's 1/4 inch thick. The blade steel is 1095, which is good. Which is good. I don't really have an issue with that. They put some black traction coating on it. And it's grayish micarta, linen micarta. Well, they call it black linen micarta. It's fucking gray. It's gray with a black blade. And the shape of the blade really adds to it. The Tanto shape, but also the back side of it, right? The back side of it where you would either have a flat spine or some funky commando type of knives might have serrations. Well, these look like serrations from the side, but then when you look from the top, well, it's really just sawteeth. 1/4 inch thick sawteeth. It's actually meant for, like, cutting out grooves for tent pegs and shit like that. I haven't tried that yet. That's real short. It's probably 1.5 1/3 inches of saw. It's not a lot. I'm curious to see exactly what it'll cut, how well, you know. I ain't tested it yet. I've tested some on the front end, some tasks around the job here, including chopping at like a crepe myrtle shoots, right? It's not bad at that. It's just not really a good shape for chopping shit. Cleavering type of stuff, food prep it would be good for. Scraping because of that Tanto edge it would be good for. Opening packages because of that Tanto edge, again, would be good for that. This is thick and sturdy. I could probably pry stuff if I can get about 1 inch deep without worrying about breaking it. I love the knife. I love the way it looks. I like the way it feels. It's heavy, right? It's 15 ounce. The sheath comes with it. You get a black Kydex type of sheath, and I'm not really a fan of them. They're kind of noisy. But this one is cool because it spins. Its tension is right. What sucks about it is you can't adjust the tension on it. I would think for... It's a $160 knife, okay? It ain't no cheapo. when you're getting that, you want a sheath that you can adjust as time goes by. But as it is, out of the box, off the shelf, the sheath works great. It holds on to everything, but if you pull it out, it comes out. So it's one-handed, easy in, easy out. And so far, I'm fucking happy with it, okay? So far, it's full tang. Don't get me wrong. It's full tang, and it's exposed at the bottom as a glass breaker and a face breaker, whatever the case may be, whatever your needs are at a given moment. It's a solid, sturdy knife, and this is kind of the initial impressions part of it. I really have to beat on it in time, and I intend to use this as everyday carry, again, because it's fixed blade, it's out, exposed on my belt. It's kind of large, walking around the workplace, and really in public too. People are going to like notice it. It's 10 inches long. Even though it's a 5-inch blade, you got a handle on it. It's 10 inches. And that kind of sticks out. We'll see how far I can go with it, how long I can get away with it. I have done fixed blades at work and not really had any issue, but it just takes one person to feel uncomfortable and complain about it. We'll see how it goes, right? So that's the one downside with it, is you can't really hide it. It's not a concealable knife, but I keep a little pocket knife in the back also. I got my Kershaw Knockout, which I've spoken about here a couple of times. I could carry both of them, right? And I will, and I do. It's fine. They're both quick. Out to shoot quick, all one-handed, and it's a good setup I got here. I think eventually I'll top it off. I'll dig up one of my Leatherman multi-tools, and that'll be it. I'll be equipped on this job, just walking around, and I can hit things in stride, and that's the ultimate ambition. But that does not conceal the fact that I've got a little bit of an addiction to knives going here. And my buddy says, and I quote, "You got it bad." And I do. But this, I got a feeling I'm currently happy with it, and I think I'm going to stay that way. We'll see how it goes, and I'll follow up on it in the future. The Topps Knives Steel Eagle 105D. First fucking kid on the block. I'm never the first with anything, but here we go. Here we go.
Waltz across Texas. Any and all things Lone Star State.
For your education and entertainment, here's a couple of things. A couple of Texas things, right? DFW, right? Post Arlen, Texas. North Texas, as it's also called, is at the bottom of Tornado Alley, right? Tornado Alley, that infamous stretch of geography that runs across the plains and prairies in the United States, and in some people's considerable estimate has grown to include a good chunk of the Southeast too, like Arkansas and into Alabama that-a-way, because of prevalence of tornadoes, right? Tornado action fucking area. It happens as a result of converging weather patterns that come into play, and we get these outbreaks of very dangerous and destructive storms that are tornadic, but also will include hail and lightning and thunder, right? Severe thunderstorms, as they're called. So when you live in Tornado Alley, there are certain measures that are taken, civic measures that are taken to inform and protect society. And what we have is a system here in Tornado Alley in North Texas of tornado alarms that sound off, right? Here's how it works. You live in a county. somewhere in that county, you get a tornado warning, right? Meteorologists identify rotation on their radar and other indicators. There may be on-the-ground spotters witnessing a funnel cloud. When that happens, tornado warning is issued, and if the warning is for your or in your county, the entire county's sirens will go off. The tornado sirens go off, right? And when you hear those, it's like, well, shit, you know, this is impending fucking doom, right? You're gonna get hit with a tornado. Well, in Texas, it's not really the case. The counties are the size of some states, right? So if I live in the southeast corner of one county and the warning is in the northwest corner of the county, I might not even see fucking clouds. It's that dramatic, right? But the sirens may go off anyway. And that's basically more or less how it works. But when you hear that sirens, it's a real serious deal, you know. And you have to at least figure out what the hell's going on. You know, now I've got rudimentary meteorological knowledge enough that I could see radar and assess what's going on and kind of forecast probabilities for areas of my concern. I'm pretty good at it, right? I'm pretty good at it. I think you have to be. I think when you move into an area prone to disastrous storms, you have to have an idea, a knowledge about disastrous storms. No different than when you move into an area that has poisonous snakes and poisonous spiders. You need to kind of get an education in these things, be able to identify them, to know how to deal with them, how to avoid them, whatever, right? Because you don't want to be dead. And you don't want the people you love to be dead. You don't want people in general to come to harm if you've got any kind of conscience at all. And as a man, of course, you've got that knack, that nature to protect others. And that's how it comes into play with me. I have lived in many different areas throughout the United States in my life, and every time I go into a new place, I get the lowdown. I look at what I may expect to happen. And it could be big things like massive storms and killer tornadoes. And it could be little things like, hey, don't leave your boots out on the porch because scorpions are going to go nest inside it overnight. And when you put them on in the morning, you're going to get stung. That's not that big a deal here. It can happen in North Texas, but in West Texas, it will happen. Out in the hill country, it probably will happen. South Texas, probably going to happen. And that's just a little thing you might not know coming down from Minnesota or over from New York or wherever. You know, you might not think, you wouldn't know to think of that kind of thing in the first place. So wherever I go, I get the lay of the land. I find out what's dangerous, what are problems, and how to protect myself and others, right? So here we have these tornado sirens that go off. And not only do they go off when there is imminent threat in your county, they also go off the first Wednesday of every month at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which is 15 minutes ago. I came out here and the sirens are going off, right? But I know it, you know. You learn that over time. Now, if you're not aware of that, it's a cloudy day and it looks kind of like dark in the west, and you hear a rumble of thunder and all of a sudden that fucking siren goes off, well, you're going to think, hell and high water, here comes a tornado, here comes the hail, here comes all that bad shit, right? That would be unfortunate. Clear blue sky today, a couple of cottony puffs of clouds floating through very slowly. Air is still, high pressure dominating. Nice summer day, not that hot, around 90 degrees. And there goes the siren going off. Now it'll run for about 2 minutes or so. but it's the first Wednesday every month. Most towns around has that, right? And it's just, it's a strictly Texas thing. Another thing, I don't know if it's strictly Texas, but it definitely is. And I don't even know if it's all Texas, but it definitely is this part, right? Garland, Texas, USA, which incidentally, my wife and I happened to have been driving through on the way out. We went this weekend to the ginormous flea market out in Van Zandt County, the town of Canton, Texas. They have the flea market there. It's the first Monday trade days. I've talked about that at length. And last time I spoke about it, I kind of bagged it, right? Kind of harsh. Overcrowded. Last time we went, it was overcrowded. And just, I was ornery. And still, I like to go to it. And we had the fortune of going when a couple little rogue thunderstorms had popped up. We went early in the morning. Skipped church, right? Not to do this, we just skipped church and then decided, well, shit, let's go do something, right? So Sunday morning, when most people in Texas seem to be at church, we were playing hooky. And so it was thinned out crowd to begin with. But when we pulled up there, these pop-up thunderstorms kind of came through. It never really got bad. It just rained a little bit and it looked ominous. There was a little rumble of thunder here and there. So we went in and the place was comparably empty. I mean, compared to last time, in relation to last time, it was easily 1/10 of the people, right? It was a joy. You had elbow room. You could move around and, you know, you weren't getting fucking elbowed and people weren't stopping short in front of you. There's just room to go. The situation was, though, the rain was a little bit off and on. So all my wife and I managed to do was kind of hit all the indoor. There's a lot of indoor buildings that they have. And then they have this backside, the less expensive rental area, where really you'll find the good cheap shit. Just things that people have cobbled together on their own, crafts and findings and things. And they just throw down a blanket, you know, fucking sell it to you. You haggle with them and everything. You know, old flea market style. Problem I have without regards to the density of the population attending the flea market out there is the professional element of it. You got people that this is what they do for a living. They buy and resell. And a lot of the shit that they buy and resell is really just commercial stuff. It's not like they're pickers that go out and find it somewhere. They're not garage sale hunters. Or some of them are. Most of the people who do the garage sale hunting I've noticed around here, and this is a thing, right? They'll go out to garage sales, they'll haggle stuff, get it cheap, they'll steal things probably too. I mean, my experience in conducting garage sales, yeah, there's thieves that show up. You got to keep your eye on them. And what they'll normally do, the cheapest way for them to turn that stuff around is to just do a garage sale on their own, right? They go gather from garage sales and then they go sell them at their own place. They know the prices they paid. They mark everything up and that's that. That's business to them, right? But some of them will turn up at flea markets. It's just you've got the overhead of rent and transportation and all that shit, right? If it's convenient to you, it's convenient to you. But you got a lot of just straight up resellers, people who will, basically they're operating a store without a brick and mortar store, right? They order stuff and then they just throw it in a trailer, haul it off to Canton Flea Market or whatever other trade days is going on during the course of the month here in Texas. And their brick and mortar store is really just a couple of tables that they rent in the flea market there. And they put everything back in the trailer and go home and try it next weekend, you know? But why wouldn't I just go to a fucking store to buy the shit? Am I getting any deep discount? No, there's no discount or nothing. Flea markets used to be a place where you could grab a couple of odd knick-knack items. You know, the thing is, like, nobody, you were like a very specialized customer. You would find some odd thing on a table that nobody in the world would want, let alone pay money for. But it's something that reminds you of something from 1932 when you were a kid, and you just got to have it for nostalgia, you know? That, and then some craftsmanship, and whatever. But it was always about just getting some cheap but generally useful things. And it's not that anymore. It's just it's more of a shopping mall than a flea market. So issue with that. I didn't mean to get into all that right now. That's not a Texas thing I wanted to talk about. On the way out there, going through Garland, Texas, right? We see these signs, and it happens every time there's a holiday that will potentially involve fireworks, right? Now, you might see signs in your town, ordinance number whatever, by the order of the city or whichever, there are to be no fireworks within city limits, right? That's common to see around. And then, but in certain towns, like Garland, Texas, they have signs about no discharging of firearms, right? It's like there's people that's their fireworks. Happy 4th of July. Slug a beer and then boom, blow off your hand cannon up into the air, right? But the thing about it is, these signs are not in the English language. They're not. They're all in Spanish. It must be Latino custom to celebrate by the discharge of firearms straight up into the air. And that's really not cool. I'm a gun guy, and any excuse to shoot's a good enough excuse for me, but this is no excuse, right? I'm also a responsible gun guy. What goes up must come down. You're going to shoot a fucking chunk of lead and copper up into the air. That's coming down on something somewhere. And if you're in a city like Garland, Garland's a city, right? It is a city. You are probably... You've probably got like within a 1 in 100 chance of dropping your projectile on top of somebody's fucking head. Or at least in their house, through their roof, into their car, some shit, some damaging type of thing. It's just not a good idea. Fireworks are not a good idea in a city because of the fire hazard that comes with it. Houses are in close proximity. You got the lawns are starting to dry up because it's summertime and the rain has abated very much. And it will get worse before it gets better. It's just not a good idea, you know. You go out to the country for that shit. And take your chances out there. At least you start a fire. You're not going to burn a house down doing it. And not going to be, you know, pissing off the neighbors with their sensitive dogs and their own personal sensitivities. But yeah, this is a thing. This is a thing in post-Arlen, Texas, where we've got a Latino community that are apt to discharge firearms, and they have to have specially targeted signage put up throughout the city to explain to them that this is not really socially acceptable behavior, right? I don't know if this is the case in your neck of the woods or not, but it is in ours for sure. And I'm going to say that in my neighborhood, I heard a couple of fireworks go off fairly locally, small-time stuff, like maybe a bottle rocket or something, which is enough to light the neighborhood on fire. Our fucking houses are tinderboxes out there, but it was kiddie stuff. It was nothing grand. And I did not hear any kind of firearms go off throughout the weekend. So, maybe people are reading those fucking signs. Eh? Maybe they are. Yeah, but no. That's it. That's it for Texas things for this week.
It's going to be biblical. A weekly dose of Christian perspective.
This week I have pulled up another random Bible verse for the Bible section of this audio podcast. And the verse that came up randomly is from the Gospel of John. Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 16, right? John 15, 16. And it reads like this. This is Jesus Christ speaking, and he's speaking to his apostles, right? Ye, this is the King James Version, ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you, that ye should go up and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. Okay? So this is Jesus Christ speaking to his apostles. Let me draw that context for you further. Right? He's speaking of several verses addressing what he calls his disciples, specifically earlier on. And my point in bringing the full context up, the intended audience, when you are trying to establish Bible context, is really fucking important, right? And an easy way to go about the context is to determine who the intended audience is. Now, any kind of Bible verse, including this one, is something that can be easily misconstrued and misappropriated by people who are either ignorant or wicked or both. The way that John 15, 16 generally would get twisted up is this idea that Jesus does not choose, or we do not choose Jesus. We as disciples of Jesus Christ don't choose Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ chooses us. We don't have a say in the matter. This is where some particular, and I'll call it by name, Reformed Protestant Christians get this notion of no free will, right? The idea that we generally don't really have a free will. We think we do, but we really don't. You know, it's all God's will, and it just appears to us that we have our own. And this is the kind of verses of scripture that people will build that. Well, let's just be straight about it. Fucked up conception out of, right? Jesus, here's where context matters. Jesus is saying ye, right? This old English of the King James Version. Ye have not chosen me. Who's ye? Well, it was the disciples. And who the disciples were to Jesus then, as it were his apostles, the inner 12, right? The ones who went with him everywhere. That's what it was like. This was the relationship between rabbi and student. The students of the rabbis went with him everywhere. It's like the disciples that he's speaking to are like the disciple with a capital D. And then you have other disciples that follow and abide, but they are not like constantly with the teacher, right? And a lot of the things that Jesus says to the apostles, we as faithful Christians 2,000 years later appropriate in our own egocentricity as something Jesus is speaking directly to us. This is not the case here. Now, there is some relevance. What he is saying to the apostles in this particular verse is that the apostles are ordained, right, by Christ. Ordained is a key word in here, too. Not every faithful Christian is ordained. And the ones who think they are ordained, like me, for example, right? I have mentioned before, I'm ordained in a local biker church. I'm an ordained minister. That is not the ordination that Christ is talking about. There's an ordination that belongs to the church specifically. It goes from Christ to the apostles, from the apostles to the bishops, who in turn ordain priests and deacons and subdeacons, right? The rest of the clergy, right? And that process of ordination connects the clergy through the centuries, indeed, through the millennia, all the way back to this moment here, Jesus Christ ordaining his capital D disciples. It's a key word in the text here. Ordination, it matters. So Christ ordains these particular disciples to go out and bring forth fruit, that is Christian talk for spread the gospel message. Help people to understand. And then the rest of the verse, Jesus is telling these specific people, okay, whatever they ask of the Father in his name, right? We pray to God the Father, creator of all things, in the name of Jesus Christ, affirming our faith, right? Meeting God on God's terms is affirming our faith in Jesus Christ, because those are the terms of God. You've heard me say this before. We ask of the Father in the name of Jesus Christ, and he will give it to us whatsoever. All right? This is not a promise to me, Maverick 88, faithful Christian, ordained in a biker church. This is a promise to the very disciples who would become known as the apostles upon this ordination. They get whatever they ask. I, as a faithful Christian, 2,000 years later, not ordained in the line of Christ's ordination, which some might call the line of Melchizedek, right? Think about that. If you know about that, I'm not going to get into that. That's a way of a side jack. But anyway, the apostles were ordained with a specific commission, and they needed things to be done. They were completely trusted. They were educated in ways that books can't even do. They were with their mentor, their teacher, their rabbi continually for 3 years plus, right? And he revealed to him all kinds of stuff that don't even appear in Scripture and everything they knew. These were specially ordained, specially commissioned, specially assigned people, and they were given this special promise in trust of who they were as chosen by Christ to get anything they needed from God to accomplish the ends that they were commissioned to. That needs to be understood, and that's where the context matters, right? We are, I'll use the word again, egocentric. What happens with our egocentricity? Everything is about us. We see that here, and we see that like in Revelation, right? We see all these crazy symbols, and the end of the world is here, and it has to be attached to me somehow, right? The egocentricity reading and misappropriating prophecy is legendary in Christianity, and probably in other bases of faith as well, because that's just human nature, self-centeredness, right? Egocentricity. So we do the same thing with this kind of scripture, and we come up with this idea that God has chosen me too, right? God chose the apostles, but he calls them disciples, and I'm a disciple. Therefore, he chose me also. Therefore, I didn't make the choice, right? Here I am, God's special chosen one. You see what starts to happen? Now, I am held aloof and above all others, and I go through the world as some specially appointed ambassador, which is what apostle generally means, right? Ambassador. Which is a whole bunch of really, well, use the word again, egocentric. Use another word, narcissistic. Use another word, vain. Bullshit. There were apostles in this world, and I am not one of them. Neither are you. Ambassadors to some level, perhaps, but not specially gifted the way the apostles were. That's an important distinction to make. It happens in the gospel where Jesus speaks multiple times, where we are quick to assume that we are the target audience when in fact we're not. We're a secondary audience. But we see some of the principles that come in here too, right? As we read within the bounds of the context, the very next verse, right? Verse 17, John 15:17. These things I command you, that ye love one another, right? And here comes Jesus talking about this love of one another as this necessary thing, as this commanded thing. And again, that gets misappropriated also. By who? Everybody. See, everybody. People who hate Jesus Christ, people who hate Christianity, people who hate Christians, people who hate the church, all this, right? Somewhere along the way, they find out that Jesus commanded to love everybody. And with their egocentric nature, their narcissism and vanity, they expect that everybody includes them. Well, they don't. This example of Christ's command to love one another is specifically oriented to his disciples. As I said before, with a capital D. And then you might tack on to that lowercase d, a person like me, a student of Christ, but not a direct apostle, not a capital D disciple, a little lowercase d disciple. What do I mean to say? That command may extend to me, that I will love my brothers and sisters in Christ also. This does not automatically mean to love every single person in the world. And a lot of Christians go by that, right? Now, we are to give, to offer Christ to everybody, and that is what love is, ultimately. God is love. You love somebody, you give somebody God. Whether they want it or not isn't really relevant to your mission of loving somebody. Loving in the biblical sense does not entail fondness. My enemy, who I am commanded to love, right? I do not have fond feelings for an enemy. An enemy is an enemy, and if my perspective on that person changed, they wouldn't be an enemy anymore. In a way, that's the ambition of loving your enemy. But how do you love your enemy when your enemy is your enemy? You don't have a fondness for that person. Because fondness is not love. Fondness is fondness. It's some kind of affection. And it's driven by some kind of personal need. Personal association. God is love. Therefore, love is God. If you want to love somebody, you give them God. Whether or not they want it, it's between them and God and the devil. But my job as a Christian, as an ambassador of Christ, is to extend that love forward. And that's how I love you, right? That's how I love you. Now, if you're one of those pride people, for one example, out there with the flag, and you hate Jesus Christ because you can't find a place in Christ because things of the Bible and things of the church are always working against your immorality, it is my loving affection to still persist in drawing the factual picture of your circumstance in the here and hereafter and not be dismayed by your feelings, by your demands to be tolerated. Again, I am to give you God, and you work between yourself and God and the devil with that knowledge. For me to say, yeah, you know what, you can be gay and you can be anti-Christ and you're okay, you're fine, would be the most hateful thing I can do. That is absolutely devilish wickedness to allow you to walk off into the lake of fire. That is hatred. And it's hatred with a smile on the face, holding hands, googly eyes. That's how it's covered up. That's how it's hidden. People smack you upside the head with a 2x4 and play you straight and make you know that's what the love is. See, sometimes love is tough love. Tough love is a reality in this world. I, as a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, have been subjected to tough love, and it helped me to overcome. And I have now a high regard for it. But anyway, all this is, again, an example of the way a single verse of Scripture can be misappropriated. And it is so common. And we need to be so careful. Theology is based off of this shit. Entire churches, right? In Protestantism, they go off on one of their 10,000 fucking directions on the whim of misunderstanding this, not putting things in its proper context. Verses in the Bible generally do not stand alone. They operate within a fuller, more complete context. And it's up to us to be thorough in formulating that context so we properly understand everything that is said within the parameters of that context. It's work. To be a Christian, it is work, because the devil and all of his minions are everywhere all the time in this world, trying to confuse us, trying to dissuade us, trying to run us the fuck off a course. We must be diligent. We must be vigilant, doggedly pursuing faith, righteousness, understanding. Because in the end, it's everything. But there you go. Man, I get a lot of miles out of a couple of words, don't I? John 15, verse 16. That is your Bible for the week.
The New Abnormal. Subject matter related to the culture war.
Heading into the holiday weekend, right? The four-day Independence Day weekend. Because Independence Day fell on a Tuesday this year. A lot of people took Monday off and concatenated that shit onto the two-day weekend. Then you got four-day weekend, right? So we had the four-day Independence Day celebration weekend, and it kicked off with a political and cultural bang. As the week last week closed out, we had the active Supreme Court of the United States sessions wind down and close, and they released a lot of decisions in a flurry of activity. Three big culturally impacting decisions, and then a handful of some lesser decisions. I'm going to focus on three of them, with most attention on one. Now, the three of them collectively are A, this Biden student loan payoff scheme, this promise that he made to his very youthful and leftist constituency of the Democrat Party, where he was basically going to use taxpayer funds to pay off their student loan debt. Okay, that was fucking dead in the water, and I'll get into that in a minute. The second thing I'm going to address, and briefly, keep it as brief as I can, affirmative action was also decided against, right, as being unconstitutional. Affirmative action. What was affirmative action? Affirmative action was that you could define it different ways. There's probably a textbook definition of it that differs than my personal definition of it. Somewhere between the two is another assortment of definitions of it. But the way I look at affirmative action is it's basically a way of giving reparations without actually saying you're giving reparations, right? Or pseudo-reparations is another way of saying it. What it was a means, and it started 30 to 35 years ago. It was a means of fighting against the sense of exclusion in Ivy League colleges, right? Where their admissions process seemed to preclude people of black skin tone, right? Negroids. And the intent was to deal with this situation as a systemic problem, right? Something, a racist problem, a racial problem inherently bound to the way things worked. So what affirmative action set to do was force these institutions to admit by quota certain amounts of this particular race of people. All right? So the problem was racism, and their solution was racism, and the result is ongoing racism. Go figure, right? Because racism plus racism equals racism. Two wrongs don't make a fucking right. And to top it all off, I mean, that's just basic math and philosophical thinking, sociological thinking. Constitutionally speaking, it was completely out of bounds as well. Discrimination by race. I mean, it's explicitly stated in the Bill of Rights. It's a part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Plainly, clearly, absolutely unconstitutional. And now it's been adjudicated as such as a result of some lawfare brought about by Asian students. Or I think it was a group that felt disparaged by the University of North Carolina and Harvard University for earning by merit qualifications to enter into these schools, but being precluded because racial quotas that had to be met. Something on those lines, right? The bottom line is it got to the Supreme Court of the United States, and it was deemed an unconstitutional practice. Affirmative action, therefore, will no longer exist. It is not going to be a part of academia going forward. And, of course, it also bled over into employment hiring practices. And it has been that case. There was always quotas. There was tax deductions and tax write-offs for companies that participated in affirmative action. And I suffered the consequences of that when I was trying to start into a career. I don't want to get into the story of it all. I do, but I don't. I don't have time for that shit right now. All right. So you got a Biden student loan payoff. You got affirmative action. And the third one is what I'm calling the creative integrity issue. And that's the case where we had a website developer in Colorado refuse to serve a couple of homosexuals with her website services. And at face value, it looks just like the old story of the homosexuals that went into the bakery and the baker wouldn't serve them cake or whatever, pastries, because they were gay. Told them to get the fuck out of the store, right? Straight up I get bigotism, I guess you'd call that, right? And well, discrimination is the proper word. Straight up discrimination because they were gay. This is not the case in this story. This case has a little bit more depth to it, right? A little bit more depth, and I'll get into that momentarily. So let me back up, and I'll touch a little bit more on the other two. The Biden student loan payoff thing is, well, exactly what it says. It was a promise that he made during his electoral campaign in the godforsaken year of 2020, right? In his insane communist Chinese theater productions, the Marxist little circles that were drawn. Oh my God. We're all going to have to remember that year for the rest of our lives. And hopefully it's in the shadows of the gallows. Anyhow, a promise was made to his constituents that he was going to push through legislation to pay off their student loan debt, right? And that's good news for a whole lot of people. A, there's a lot of students out there. B, most of them have taken out loans to get through college. C, it's thousands and thousands of dollars for people in debt. D, they don't get out of that debt through halfway through their adulthood, generally speaking. E, a lot of them default and cause financial instability for the nation. F, where the fuck are you supposed to get the money from to do this? Of course, you're taking it right out of our taxpayer taxes. The United States of America revenue. So you're making somebody who either A, didn't go to college, or B, went to college and has paid off their loans, or C, is paying off their fucking loans and refuses to have somebody pay for them, to pay for somebody else's student loan, somebody else's debt. Why don't you just buy everybody a fucking car? A jet, a house. So this scumbag, and he's a scumbag. Let's pull no punches here, right? It's a grifter. It's a fucking organized crime family, and it's just a sector of greater organized crime interests that have taken over the government of this country, okay? But make no bones about it. The guy's a fucking scumbag. He's a career scumbag. Any senator is a scumbag, almost invariably, all right? In the 90 percentile, all right? What the fuck? Just look around you. You got United States senators. What do? They're legislators. They write and approve. They vote on law. They argue law, right? And they come up with law. That's what they do. They serve United States law. Domestic policy is what it is. Why are so many of them involved internationally in Ukraine? Why are there so many pictures from 2014 with John McCain in Ukraine and this scumbag asshole Lindsey Graham or whatever the fuck his name is in South Carolina? Why the fuck has Joe Biden got so many interests as a senator and then a vice president, who is the president of the Senate, by the way, right? Those are scumbags. They have no business out there, except they are using their power and selling their influence, right? They're selling out the country to do it. They're all a bunch of scumbags. So when I say Joe Biden is one of them, he's one of them. There's a whole bunch of them, but he's definitely one of them, right? And this idea that he is going to shove legislation through the system that's going to pay off the student debt of the people that he's trying to get to vote for him, right, is exactly what it looks like. It's just a scam. There's no way on God's green earth that that's ever going to be approved of. You already know, you know, before the election goes through in that year and before the 2022 election comes around that might upset the apple cart, you already know that the balance of power in the Supreme Court heavily favors conservative ideology, which abides by the Constitution. In case you didn't know, that's what conservative means. It would never fly. But don't tell these college students and recent college graduates and college graduates who are dicking around the idea of maybe entering into the workforce someday when mom and dad has had enough of them in the basement jerking off and eating donuts all day long, right? These are the fucking people They're like, yeah, dude, pay off my thousands of dollars and fuck everybody else in the country, right? And that's what exactly, that's the attitude right there. That's part of the un-American party. That's what I regard the Democrat Party as, the un-American party. Everything about them is destroying this fucking place. Everything about them is about hatred. It's generating hate. It's causing division. It's spewing vitriol. And it's promoting vile imagery to destroy the mainstream healthy culture, this multicultural and secular culture, this incredible vision that people had from a couple hundred years ago that actually holds true within the confines, within the parameters of the Constitution. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And yet people are made to feel or invited to feel marginalized. And when they're marginalized, they reach out for anybody who will help them. And that's what the Democrats are. They collect up all these marginalized groups of people. They label them in various assortment of ways, but they all fall under the Democrat umbrella. And if any of them ever grew up and accepted reality, came to the truth of things, took up their own responsibility and made lives for themselves without leeching off of everybody else, there would be no Democrat Party. But I digress, right? Joe Biden's idea that he was going to get legislation through never had a toe, let alone a foot, to fucking walk on. But he persuaded his marginalized constituency of the opposite. And they were wrong, you know. Now, I'm not going to stand here and say Joe Biden's stupid about this. No, he's not. He's not. He knew that this was going to play out this way. The guy has a career in politics, and his career is not like 8 years. His career is from like the time I was 5 fucking years old, and I'm an old man, right? 40 plus, somewhere between 40 and 50 years in politics at the federal fucking level. The guy's not stupid. He knows how to play the game. He knows how to play people, especially marginalized leftist idiots. And that's exactly what he did. See, he's not the dummy. The dumb people are the ones who bought this fucking shit from him, right? But no, unconstitutional. You're not taking money out of other people's pockets to pay for your fucking debts. Ain't happening. Go cry to your mommy and daddy. One day they'll stop paying for your fucking debts too, right? Happens to us all. Too bad, so sad, as my Marine Corps senior drill instructor used to say. Affirmative action, I already spoke to in plain terms, probably expressed enough of the point about that. The one thing I didn't say, right, and I just mentioned as I was talking about this other Biden student loan payoff, this idea, this grand idea of the United States of America based on civil rights, civil liberties, drawn up in the Enlightenment period as a secular state, right? The separation of church and state is the idea that you don't have a state-sponsored church. Therefore, without that, people are free to practice whatever religion, but the government is set apart from supporting a particular religion, right? That's the separation of church and state. That's not a constitutional thing. It's a philosophical thing written and attributed to the guy who wrote so much of our founding documents, Thomas Jefferson, again, who was an Enlightenment era kind of guy, right? But that's the basic premise of this nation from the get-go, right? And it's happened. You have the greatest effort ever to make a secular / multicultural nation in the history of humanity. And it has gone through some growing pains. It has gone through some difficulties. A lot of the stories are horrible. And when we're young and we read them, we become disillusioned with the whole idea of the country. But when we grow up and realize what's really happened here is the design of the function of the Constitution was meant to get us through these growing pains, then you realize we really got something special going here if only we accept it, right? Now, the realization came to me as a process of maturing, but early on in my maturity, when I was in the military, I made observations. I was assigned a rack in a barracks, like so many, you know, 40, 50, 60 other guys. And it turned out these other guys were this color and that color and this other color and this other color and the skin tone. And they come from this state and that state and this other state. And they have this kind of accent and that kind of accent. You see where I'm going? A cross-section of America happens in Marine Corps basic training boot camp and the rest of your military experience to follow that. But it starts there in basic training. And what happens there is you have people of all colors and creeds and languages and whatever, all types, from all varied subcultures within the varied regions of this great nation of ours, gathered together in one room and put to the challenge of operating as a single functional unit to a single end on a daily basis. And the result of that is a collective mainstream culture. This is what happens when you put all kinds of Americans in one room. They become American. They express American. They reveal American. The whole is made of the parts, but becomes its own separate entity. And it's something that we all share in, but we can also do so without revoking participation in the cultures that we come from. That's why we have terms like Mexican American, Black American, Redneck. But we're still all American. We all come from a subculture that is part of what makes America American. It exists, these subcultures, on their own volition, but they're an integral part of the collective whole, which again I say is its own beast. If we really were to go to war as a country, because we see what happened in 9/11, right? When 9/11 happened, it was one of those rare times that everybody kind of just got together all of a sudden. It's like, all right, wait, America is under attack. Pearl Harbor, right? We have these moments periodically in history that kind of smacks us upside the head and reveals to us our collective whole, our mainstream culture, right? There is one dominating culture in this country that all of us are a part of. Many of us accept it, many of us reject it, but it's a fact of being, and it's evident in the military as that experience. And the result of your experience in the military is you come out of it very aware of this fact. Now, affirmative action, right? Talking about affirmative action, that is something that is attributed directly to a particular race of people. People known as African American, people known as Black, people known as colored, people known as Negro. But the American variety of it, because there's so many varieties of black-skinned people in the world, right? Ain't just one. But particularly in the United States, right? You got American people who are black of skin color, Negroid of racial feature is probably a better technical way of expressing it. They are granted particular favor, right, in affirmative action. Our Black America is not some kind of single-minded amoeba. There's variance even within that. There is subculture to the subculture. And what do I mean by that? Pardon my fan here. What do I mean by that? It's exactly the things that I'm talking about, right? There is this black flavor of culture in the United States of America. And there is this grand element that is catered to by Democrat politicians who work feverishly to attain their constituency treasures like affirmative action. But these black Democrats that desire that sort of thing do not speak for the whole of the culture. Because many of these racially identifiable Negroid types of people within the confines of the borders of the United States of America have gone through the military just like I did. And they saw just what I saw. They felt what I felt, and they realized what I realized. They know what I learned. They're Americans too. They're part of the whole composition of what makes America, America, what makes an American. There is definitely a difference between people. Just within the limitations of culture attributed racially to those who are black, or attributed to those who are racially black. There's no black man out there that speaks for the whole of all the rest of the black men, or is there a white one that does it? Or a yellow one, or a red one, or a brown one, in any color you like. Nobody speaks for the collective whole. All these racial issues, like I said, they are to a man, right? To a man. And racial orientation is stupid anyway. I'm speaking to it because this is my response to it speaking to me. Affirmative action was racism disguised as combating racism, where what it really did was perpetuate racism. But there are people in this country who have had the experience of mainstream America. And I'm not talking about TV. Okay, that's not it. I'm talking about Marine Corps barracks. I'm talking about Army barracks. That's where mainstream America actually lives. Those of us who got to experience that have more the patriotic sense, have more the collective sense, have more this idea of looking past the physical features of people into their eyes, the windows of their mind, looking into their heart, the base of their faith, looking into the actual content of their character as expressed through the things that they do. It's the kind of thing that people really want to happen. But it's a laborious process. One man after the next. There's no sweeping change that a government can impact on society to make this happen and happen now. But things like recognizing affirmative action as unconstitutional is recognizing it as a form of racism, and by outlawing it out and by putting it out of practice, you're taking that element of racism out of our entire cultural composition as Americans, and probably setting both course and wind in the sails to the direction of overcoming this racial problem. Let me move on from this racial shit. I hate talking about that stuff. Because it's bullshit, okay? It's bullshit. It is jailhouse, jail yard mentality. It's the lowest form of human thought and expression. A racist is somebody with a racial orientation. What does that mean? A racial orientation means you see race behind every tree and under every rock. Everything is race, race, race. And I don't care what race you are. This is not exclusive to any race. Every person that is racially oriented, okay, they think racially. They decide racially. They assess people racially, right? Or racist. If you're one of those, you're racist, you got a problem. You got a character flaw. You got a character issue that you have to deal with. Stop pointing the finger. Okay? Just admit. Admit where you're fucked up. Admit where you have fucked up. And stop fucking up. We don't need a racially oriented society here. And you can't sing the blues over something that happened to people multiple generations ago. You can't do that. My father was born in a concentration camp. That is a fact. He's an actual slave. My grandparents were actual slaves. My uncles and aunts were actual slaves. I knew them. They hung out with me. We drank beer together. They raised me. I have no gripe. That was a fucked up circumstance. And my grandparents and their generation had to overcome that circumstance. And my father and uncles and aunts and their generation had to overcome that circumstance. And I had to, in my generation, overcome that circumstance. Yes, there is carryover generation to generation. There is impact when a family has to incur that kind of tragedy and abuse and mistreatment. But it's for every one of us to overcome it. If we don't have a tale, if we don't have a situation to overcome, we don't even have a story in this world. What the fuck am I without a story, right? We all have a story. Our own story. I don't have my grandfather's story. I heard it. I know it. Part of my story is attached to that, but it ain't the same story. I got a different story. I can't claim any rights. I can't go knock on Germany's door. I can't go to the German embassy in Washington, D.C. and say, hey, motherfucker, you owe me reparations. It's nonsensical. Although, I guess Germany has paid out some to some anyway, so maybe it's not so nonsensical. I wouldn't think of it. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's the military. Maybe that's character. Maybe that's Christ in my heart and Christ in my head. Maybe that's just from being around good and properly oriented people for the past few years of my life. I don't know. But I do know, when I'm honest with myself, that my story is different from my grandmother's story. Though attached by blood, the experience is different. I have a completely different experience than what my Ukrainian ancestors had to go through in World War II. Because I didn't have to go through it. Anyway, all right, like I said, moving on. The final thing, the thing I really want to focus on somewhat here is the what I'm calling the creative integrity issue, right? Which was a matter out of Colorado, a website developer who would not provide service to a couple of homosexuals because the issue of same-sex marriage was involved. And it was an issue that was causing or would have caused this woman, who was the website designer, to creatively express sentiments that she is ideologically opposed to. She did not believe in same-sex marriage. She refused to do a website that promoted same-sex marriage, right? Like I expressed earlier, the difference between this and the baker and the cake and the homosexual deal that happened years earlier is that this is more specific. This ain't just the cake. This is the writing on the cake deal, right? She had to give him the cake. You can have the website. Yeah, I'll make a website for you. But now you're asking me to put this shit on it that I don't agree with. That's the difference, right? That's the letters on the cake. Or you might call it the icing on the cake. I don't know. No, I do know. So anyway, this is shot down. And there's a adequate, if not great, explanation of the case and the anticipated results of the case by Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. This is from Breitbart.com. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote that the ruling against the Christian in this case, which would be the web developer against the same-sex marriage, would set the stage for governments to force filmmakers to produce movies with messages that violate their own consciences. And here's Gorsuch speaking, writing, as the case may be. The First Amendment protects an individual's right to speak his mind regardless of whether the government considers his speech sensible and well-intentioned or deeply misguided, and likely to cause anguish or incalculable grief. Equally, the First Amendment protects acts of expressive association. Generally, too, the government may not compel a person to speak its own preferred messages, nor does it matter whether the government seeks to compel a person to speak its message when he would prefer to remain silent, or to force an individual to include other ideas with his own speech that he would prefer not to include. All that offends the First Amendment just the same. Consider what a contrary approach would mean. Under Colorado's logic, who was trying to enforce legalities related to discrimination against these LGBTQ plus people, right? Under Colorado logic, the government may compel anyone who speaks for pay on a given topic to accept all commissions on that same topic, no matter the underlying message, if the topic somehow implicates a customer's statutorily protected trait. Taken seriously, that principle would allow the government to force all manner of artists, speechwriters, and others whose services involve speech to speak what they do not believe on pain of penalty. That's what it's all about right there, the pain of penalty. Government steps in, government intercedes, and now we become criminal for trying to maintain our own creative integrity, right? Anyway, to continue on, the government could require an unwilling Muslim movie director to make a film with a Zionist message, or an atheist muralist to accept a commission celebrating evangelical zeal, so long as they would make films or murals for other members of the public with different messages. Equally, the government could force a male website designer married to another man to design websites for an organization that advocates against same-sex marriage, right? So, we see, you know, we see plainly, I think. I mean, I see plainly. Many people, millions of people see plainly. Some don't. The protective nature of this decision, right? We're protecting the creative integrity of artisans, anybody who has the creative power of speech, whether that's vocally or whether that's written, whatever the case may be. We can create something, but if that something involves a violation of our own integrity, the government cannot intercede and compel us to carry out the task. So we may have to serve the gay couple a cake, but we cannot be compelled to write a pro-gay message on that cake for them by the government. Now, they could throw in $1,000 and you could decide, fuck it, I'll sell out, right? And this is what I'm getting into right now, because one of the knee-jerk reactions, perhaps the most famous one of them all, to the outcome of the decision in this case was a guy I'm a fan of, right? I've been a fan of, Michael Imperioli. He is the known for mostly for mob movie type of stuff. He was a small role in Goodfellas, huge role, a leading role in The Sopranos, right? He played Christopher Moltisanti, and he was the voice of the dead Christopher Moltisanti in the Sopranos movie, The Many Saints of Newark, which I bring up from time to time here as it's very relative to my life as I come out of Newark, right? Brick City, baby. And like I say, I've been a fan of the guy. I have a Sopranos picture on my wall, like the whole group of them standing in front of their meat market where they hung out and did their business, right? And Michael Imperioli is in that picture. My coffee mug every fucking morning when I get up and I start doing my Bible stuff and whatever I'm into in the morning is actually a Sopranos movie directly related to Michael Imperioli's character, Christopher Moltisanti. What it is during that series, that television show, there was a point in time where Imperioli's character, Christopher Moltisanti, was branching out into the movie business. And he produced a horror movie called Cleaver. And I've got a replica coffee mug as part of the swag that came out of the production of that movie, right? I got my Cleaver coffee mug with its little logo on it, and it says produced by Christopher Moltisanti. So I'm a Sopranos fan, and I always have been, right? It's the backdrop of my life growing up. I mean, that's where I come from, right? So, and, you know, on top of that, specifically now when it comes to Michael Imperioli, not as an actor, not as a role, but as a human being, right? He and another guy who played Bobby on The Sopranos, the big hefty character, the aide to Uncle June, they did a podcast together during the COVID era, right? So many actors were out of work during that time, and a lot of them were taking to the internet and creating these podcasts. And they did a podcast called Talking Sopranos, which I guess they ran it, I don't know, 6 months to a year, something like that. And it was kind of funny. They're sort of an odd couple, right? Kind of got the big heavy guy. You kind of got the little wiry guy. You got the more conservative guy and the more liberal guy. You got the more hardy guy and the more heady guy. They were an odd couple, and they would kind of be at each other's nerves, like Felix and Oscar, you know. It was just that sort of thing. It made for decent tension. Sometimes it was a little uncomfortable and disconcerting, but it was a good podcast. And what they would do is they would talk amongst themselves, and they would tell stories and shit, and maybe clue you in on what's going on in their lives now, and just, you know, whatever. And then they would interview somebody who was part of the cast of The Sopranos, whether it was production people or whether it was actors, you know, or whether they were stars or played small roles. They had basically 52 episodes that they had to fill up, or, you know, it was a pretty long stretch, and they stuck to it and finished it out. But I tell you, they complained all along the way. I can't believe I signed up for this shit. I can't believe we still got 6 more months to do, you know. It was every week. It was an episode every week, something like that. And I thought it was fine. And I watched just about all of them, you know. I caught up, you know, there was a couple of them out when I stumbled onto it. My wife and I, we'll watch The Sopranos every other year or so. Something I do. It's almost like a little side religion of mine, you know. It just kind of takes me back home, keeps me attached to my roots a little bit. Maybe some kind of nostalgia, maybe even some kind of homesickness, but it's something I do every couple of years. And I'll go right, you know, binge watch the whole thing right through. And so I'm a fan, right? I'm a fan of the show. I'm a fan of the guy. I think he was a good actor in it. And because of the podcast, I have something of a, how do you say it? Like a personal sense of the dude, right? A podcast is not completely scripted. You shoot from the hip a lot of times. And when you're doing that, you reveal yourself a lot. And when you watch a guy's 50 or 52 weeks or whatever, I think it was a year, right? Don't hold me to that. It was a good long stretch. And week after week, you kind of get a pretty good idea who the person is. You know what I'm trying to say? I mean, it happens. If you're listening to me, you're going to get a pretty good idea who I am in time. And Yeah, that's a sense I've had. Now, not like he's my best buddy, not that he's like an idol to worship, not that he even, I don't know that we would even be friends, to be honest with you. You know, I think we can have a friendly conversation, but I think we believe differently. I think down in the core, our base beliefs, or the base of our beliefs, are different. And then from there, you just stray out in wild directions, right? But I find the guy to be introspective, inquisitive, thoughtful, conscientious. Has a depth to him. There's a certain philosophical edge to him. He's an interesting person. You couldn't have an interesting conversation with a guy like that. He's appreciable. I could appreciate the guy even if he doesn't think and believe the same way I do. There's a whole lot of mannerisms and characteristics that he has that are very similar to me, right? I could relate with them. So I don't go into this with some kind of vendetta, with some kind of personal hate, with some kind of just sour disregard for a person who's just not exactly like me, you know? It's not like that at all. No enmity at all. And I don't mean to bag the guy. A situation happened, and he, being a celebrity, he opened his fucking pie hole up, and he didn't really have the story straight. And he contradicted himself kind of grossly. Because as I read to you, right, Neil Gorsuch made the example plain that this was to protect artistic integrity. And of course, Michael Imperioli is an artist, and it protects his integrity. He made a statement that was a little bit off the wall in regards to all this, again, because obviously it was a knee-jerk reaction to a headline, a clickbait type of headline that really makes the whole situation about faggots, right? That's what it's about, right? No, it's not. It's about the artist. It's a completely different thing. The people who walk into the bakery are really irrelevant in this case. What matters is the baker and what he's got to write on the cake and whether he wants to do it or not. That's what it's all about. And then the fact of the government actually forcing him to do something that he doesn't want to do. The government can't do that. That's what the case is. But this dude did not understand at the time what that case was. He went by the fucking headlines, and then he stuck his neck out. And this is what he said on some social media. I'm not sure exactly which one, but it says, Real Michael Imperioli. And again, this caused a lot of backlash with people. It had wheels. It made its way around the internet, right? I've decided to forbid bigots and homophobes from watching The Sopranos, The White Lotus, which is, I guess, some other production he was involved in, Goodfellas, like I mentioned before, or any movie or TV show I've been in. Thank you, Supreme Court, for allowing me to discriminate and exclude those who I don't agree with and am opposed to. Then he says, USA, USA, right? Sarcastically, obviously. If you could read sarcasm, I believe I can. That was a dose of sarcasm right there. But he got it all wrong. He had no idea that the case actually benefits people like him. See, the irony, there's a bunch of ironies in here, but one particular one that just jumps out at me and probably a million other people is he's making these claims that really come off looking like virtue signaling, right? That he's not a bigot and he's not a homophobe. But the character that he played in the Sopranos was exactly that. It was a bigot. It was a homophobe. Well, I don't like the word homophobe. I'm not going to say that anybody's actually afraid of homosexuals. But he was anti-gay. Let's just put it that way, right? He was a bigot in general. He had racial orientation. It was expressed blatantly. There was a season that involved a homosexual mafioso that Christopher Moltisanti, the character this dude played, was raging against the faggotry, right? So here you got a situation where a guy actually sold himself out. He went against his principles and portrayed a part that expressed something contrary to his own self. He violated his own artistic integrity in exchange for the big dollar. But that was his choice. The government could not force him to do that by Supreme Court law. He would have been able to say, look, no, I read the script and I ain't being this guy. And the production staff could have decided to rewrite the character, write the character out, whatever. They could do whatever they would have to do to compel this guy to leave the show, but they cannot get the intervention of the government to do that for them. That's what this shit is all about. So there's a bunch of irony, you know, with his statements. And again, he came back. That was, he said that Monday and Wednesday he comes back and tries to buttress the statement, you know. He doesn't say outright that, oh, I didn't really understand the full the case and la-da-da. But, yeah, just what I really was trying to impose upon people was the fact that I'm against bigotry and homophobia, right? Okay. I'm sure he is. I'm not arguing that point. It's just he was making a point that was less than educated, right? And whatever. You know, whatever. It was really kind of fucking weird, you know? You know, and the idea, just like something else that was just wrong is like the whole idea of like he actually can make that decision, you know? Yeah. He misunderstood the Supreme Court decision. He misunderstood the case. And he had this impression that, oh, now I can be a bigot. Now I can discriminate against anybody who I don't agree with or who doesn't agree with me at will. And his example for doing that was banning people from watching film productions that he acted in, which is not for him to say. He doesn't own The Sopranos. He was a fucking bit player, an actor. I don't mean to say a bit actor, but he was, in the grand scheme of the production, he was just a dude, you know? People own that shit. The producers, the investors, they own that and they decide. This guy as an actor doesn't have the ability to make that kind of discrimination. So it's stupid, right? It's stupid. And he's smarter than that. He's more intelligent than that. He's more intellectual than that. He's more deeply thought out than that. And this is obviously a knee-jerk reaction from a guy. And I'm going to give him a pass on it. You know, I'm going to give him a pass on it. I think he was adequately ratioed. And I think that's why he came back 2 days later and tried to kind of re-explain himself, which is fine. Just fine. Now, again, he's not the president of a nation. He's not the king of the world. He's not the priest of the church. He's not nobody whose word you hang on. You know what I mean? He's a celebrity. Because he's a celebrity, you know, everybody's got an opinion. I got an opinion, right? And you could put your opinion out there. And with celebrities, it's going to get heard. With workaday Joes like me, it's not going to get heard. I don't have to answer for the things I say here unless I have a guilty conscience about it. And you see, this is the interesting thing with Michael Imperioli. I don't know if it was the ratio that happened on him or just a straight-up guilty conscience when he realized he spoke at a turn. Spoke to something he wasn't knowledgeable about. There may yet be a conscience inside that guy. And anybody who's got a conscience got a chance. You hear me talk about that. Conscience is a big deal. I really think he's a stand-up dude. I've heard enough of him. I've heard enough of him on that podcast. I think he's a stand-up guy. He don't believe like me. He don't think like me. We don't share the same base of faith, any of that. You know, we're not two peas in a pod, like I said before, but he'll be all right. This will just disappear. I'm sure he regrets it. There was a bunch of backlash. They're regarding him as a fascist, of all things, right? He's the fascist now. Why? Why? Why would Michael Imperioli be the fascist? Because he's the one that supports the government intervention, forcing creative people, artists, to do things that they stand opposed to. That's fascism. So, yeah, the poor guy, right? The poor guy. Like I said, he'll get past it. He'll get past it. Ain't the biggest problem in the world. But it was a very interesting closing to the week with all these major Supreme Court decisions. And culture is going to shift as a result of it. It doesn't all happen overnight, but it does happen. So enjoy the ride.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com. Yeah.